Blog Talk Radio.
Your host, Merle Exit. I'm here in New York City. It's 8 o'clock on my time, p.m. Well, I hear it's going to snow. Would you believe it? I mean, like, this is, well, it's going to snow tomorrow, and I don't know, it's April 1st. I don't know whether it's an April Fool's joke or not, but I hope it is. Weird. And, well, I have a heck of a show tonight. First of all, Independence Residence Incorporated. It's a company that provides services to adults with developmental disabilities. And there's a cafe, Independence Cafe, which recently opened where I am here in Woodhaven in Queens, New York City. And we're going to talk with the owner, Michael DiNatale, and Chef David about the food. Then, well, it looks like the San Diego Zoo has this fabulous safari park. And Rick Schwartz, the ambassador, as well as the senior animal keeper of the zoo, is actually here in New York City. I don't know, why is he here, and what's this park all about? Well, he'll be calling in and telling us. But right now, gotta do that commercial. What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calibo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
Yes, and you can get these absolutely delicious brownies on www.brownies.com. David, were you drooling during that? David, you're on.
Hello?
David, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
You guys are on.
yeah, we're on. This is Mike, and the other guy, he's Jimmy, though.
Oh, Jimmy.
Yeah, my name is Jimmy.
Why did I think his name was David? Okay. I'll have to change that.
You realize we were thinking about the brownies.
Yeah. Okay, Jimmy, were you drooling?
Yes. Yes, I was drooling.
All right, I want to start with Michael to tell us, like, who you are and how you got involved with this whole thing.
Well, just a bit of background. I mean, I've been with, you know, Independence Residences, IRI, on and off since, I mean, for about 10 years or so, since, you know, I was in my, the end of high school, just helping out, mostly at the beginning, just like with buildings and grounds for on and off breaks from college and that sort of thing. And basically just, you know, came to the point where we acquired the storefront where the cafe is now, and you know, I got really excited and just started getting ideas of how we could turn this, you know, the idea was to turn it into a store, and I started getting ideas of how to do it. So I got cranking in there, and that's how I sort of built it up to a store.
Well, how does you're involved with the company itself, Independence Residence Incorporated?
Yes.
Okay. Explain to my audience like what this is, what that whole thing is all about.
Okay. Well, Independence Residences, our primary service is that we provide services to adults with developmental disabilities, primarily residential services. We have, I believe it's now 14 or 13 group homes throughout New York City, our consumers, they live there. They have staff that assist them with their daily living tasks. And then during the day, they may stay home. They may go to their day program, but, you know, make sure that, you know, they're cared for, but they also do live, you know, in their own home.
Now, when you say group homes, are they taking, like, a three-family home? Or they do? I mean, what are they doing in terms of this? How is that set up?
I mean, you go to anyone house, and you know most of the guys have their own bedroom. Just you know, any of the you know any home that you might see. I'm just trying thinking of an example. Just like one of those Victorians you might have seen in Woodhaven. Just one of those houses. You know, it could be a group home. Just you know, any normal family size house. Like we have some houses where we might have, I think the smallest one has like 6 guys in it, and the largest one has around 11. You know, most of the guys have their own rooms and everything, but there's usually a shared kitchen, rec room, stuff like that. There's staff
so,
there, another, you know, 24/7.
So, I mean, like, for instance, so are they, let's just say a Victorian home, are they fixing it up so everybody has, let's say, a room and a door? I mean, like...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there might, you know, depending on you know, whatever, you know, these guys have families, too. So, I mean, depending on the family situation, the guy might have, you know, 2 guys might share a room, but a lot of them have their own room. You know, it's different with each consumer.
Okay. Who actually, like, owns, is it city-run, state-run? What is it?
It's a privately run, not-for-profit corporation. All of our funding,
okay,
comes through state programs, through Medicaid funding.
Oh, okay.
But it's actually privately owned and run through a board of directors and, you know, who appoint then the executive director.
So are they, in other words, are they, like, buying a residence, or is it something like they're renting a residence?
I mean, I'm not necessarily privy to all the business details, but, it vary from house to house.
Oh, okay. So some could be rentals and some, you know, they're actually buying out.
Well, it's just, you know, to a certain extent, right, it's like a business. It's where it's going to be worthwhile to invest money in owning something for us, whether we're not-for-profit or not. We still have to be judicious about our money. So it's
right,
going to be, you know, a calculated decision.
Oh, okay. So how many of these did you say, like, are in New York City right now?
For our agency, I think 13 or 14.
Okay. Is that throughout New York City?
Throughout New York City, primarily in Queens, but also in Brooklyn and the Bronx. And we have a few day programs and some other services as well.
Okay, because I had noticed that what is actually, I see across the street from the cafe, is that the agency? And is it looks like it's not completed, or what's the story with that?
Well,
that
our actual main office is a bit down the road from there, above the Queens County Bank, the corner of Woodhaven and Jamaica Avenue. And that's our main office. But we've been in the area for a long time. But that across the cafe there, that's basically like going to be our HR / recruiting center. You know, again, a spot opened up on the block. We decided to take advantage of it because, you know, as a growing company, we need office space. And it seemed a good way to...
Right.
You know, get our face out there, get a storefront so people can see it and take part in the community.
Okay, so, and how can people, like, take part in it? I mean, is it, you know, like, are the other residents, like, hired? Like, for instance, I understand in the cafe, you have a few people at the cafe that work.
Yeah, a few of our guys are employed at the cafe. And just, you know, a lot of our guys have, they're employed through a program called ESEMP, which is short for Enhanced Supported Employment. And just,
mm-hmm.
if one of our consumers is a candidate for the program, that, you know, they'll go through, you know, just some pre-job training to sort of get them, you know, use the idea of having a job, understanding what it is and everything. And then they come in and they work for us. You know, they'll have a staff who supports them, but I'll be honest. A couple of guys who come in there for us some of the time, they don't need their support. You know, they're pretty good. You know, but it's good. It's good to have the support there for them, so that way, if they have trouble with something, they can see how to improve on it for next time.
Okay. So in other words, because I saw, I didn't get to really talk to him, but there was one guy at the cafe. I think he would say like he would like kind of do stock stuff, delivery, things like that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the stuff that helps us, you know, helps us keep the store going, the guys do stock the drinks, you know, wipe down the tables as the customers come, sometimes bring stuff up from downstairs, help us get the salad bar case set up, whatever, you know, if we need, you know, if one of the guys is capable of doing something to help us out, we're not going to, stop them from doing it.
Oh, sure. So, in other words, what you find is there's some that have limited capabilities, and then there's others that have, I guess, a lot more, you know.
Well, yeah. There's a whole spectrum of, you know, of ability with different guys, and, you know, within different guys with certain, you know, skill sets, you know, they also have varied skill sets. Generally speaking, the guys we're working with are, you know, do pretty good stuff because they can work and hold down a job. One of our guys, this isn't their first job. One of our guys came over, he transferred over from our main office. He did a good job there. We thought he'd do an even better job at the cafe, and he's here and he's doing a good job.
Yeah, I'm curious. I know. I mean, I noticed like when I go to like Stop and Shop, are these people from the same organization? Because I know there are some people and they're that's basically they seem to be bagging.
I would say for sure they're not from our organization just because. You know, before I was managing the store, I was working in supported employment as a job coach. So I know none of our guys actually work in Stop and Shop, but I mean we're one of many, many agencies throughout the state who have forms of supported employment. You know, just Goodwill, YAI to throw out some, maybe more well-known names in the field, I guess, of dealing with people with developmental disabilities.
Right. So you can't assume it's like if somebody's physically disabled, you could be totally or partially.
Right.
You know, and it's just getting the skills. But you could also, unlike somebody, I guess if you're physically disabled. And there's a point that you can't do anything about it, you know, therapy-wise. It's not the same, like, in terms of, the developmental disabilities where you can, unless I'm wrong, I mean, you can train.
Well,
you can, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, our guys... you know, different. Like I said, different people at different levels. There's certain, you know, and a lot of our guys can learn things. I can, you know, guarantee you that one of our guys that works there, I can guarantee you that you know, within, you know, after not too long, he probably won't have to have support staff with him because, you know, he's learned what to, you know, he's learned what to do very well. I mean, you know, and just to give you an idea of, you know, the range, I mean, you know, one of our guys, you ask him, was like, I live in Manhattan. How do I get to this area of the Bronx? He'll tell you, you know, what trains you can take, what buses you can take, what's the construction going on those routes, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, they have, you know, like you say, everyone has, you know, varying levels.
Yeah, just as everyone has varying levels anyway.
Right.
You could be someplace and say, how do you get somewhere? And the person goes, I don't live there. You know what I mean? Or I have no idea, you know.
Right.
So now, in terms of the now, what did you do again prior to the cafe? And what were you doing?
Well, that's a long list. But at IRI, what I was doing, I had a few things. I mean, I essentially within the past year, I guess, held three or four different positions at IRI, and that's part of it. Just been sort of getting set up for the place and helping out as needed. But I mean, for years and years, I worked just on the buildings and grounds team where we, you know, we'll go to the houses and, you know, like I said, 14 residences, you know, year round. Every week there's going to be, you know, stuff you're going to have to do to upkeep those residences. So I help a lot with that upkeep stuff, whether it's patching a hole in the wall or doing the plumbing, that sort of thing.
Now, when you're saying like patching a hole in the wall, were you doing it yourself? Is that your skill? Or you were saying, oh, and it needs patching the wall, we got to hire somebody to patch the wall?
Well, generally, yeah, I mean, if it's patching the wall, I'm patching the wall, or one of the other guys I was working with patching the wall. You know, if the plumbing job, especially something that requires, it's anything, a lot of plumbing stuff, or most plumbing stuff requires a licensed plumber, so we really can't do, we're not allowed to do a lot of that stuff ourselves, unfortunately, but I mean, no, we do the repairs, and then there just has to be a conscious decision. Well, is it worth the time, even if we can do something ourselves, is it worth the time and money for us to do it ourselves, or not really? Because sometimes, you know, you can't put, you know, we might have to hire someone to do sheetrocking at a house, not because we can't do it, but because we still have 13 other houses to take care of.
Right.
But, yeah. I mean, the just to give you an idea, the building and ground crew we have is phenomenal group of guys. They're really capable. Like, you've been in the store. I mean, a lot, like, any of the finished work throughout the store, the wood trim, the wainscoting, the cabinet with the menus board, that was all built by our crew. I mean, skilled in, you know, carpentry, you know, plumbing the works. They, you know, the phenomenal group of guys, electricians, that sort of thing.
You know, it's funny that you said that because, as I had told you, I was at the beauty parlor, the hair salon,
right.
Across the street. And as I was chatting, of course, that's what you do. You chat with everybody, you know. I didn't have to go under the dryer to do that, though. I was chatting, and I kept what I was hearing is, oh, my God, they must have torn down every single thing and doing everything, the walls, everything. They was really fixing it up. It's so clean. It's perfect and whatever. That's what I was hearing. But nobody had eaten there yet. So I just, that's why I turned to him. I said, okay, I know. You want me to play guinea pig and go over there and have something to eat, you know. And I have to tell you what the conversation, because it was interesting. I said, because I was only able to see from across the street, I could peer in, but I couldn't really tell, you know, in terms of food or anything. And it looked basically like, okay, there's a counter, and it's probably, you know, like sandwiches, and this is what sandwiches and, you know, and cold cuts and, you know, that kind of a thing and whatever. And I had turned to the people at the in the hair salon, and I kind of said, you know, all right, I'm going to go over there. And then I said, I want to see, I mean, is it worth going there just, I mean, to eat? How about the quality of the food? And the woman's going, oh, come on, Merle, don't be so picky about it. And she's saying, you know, it's this whole independence residence thing and blah, 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 don't be so critical. And I said, no, I just want to, you know, just kind of see. I said, okay, I'm when I'm done, and I'll go there, and I'll report back to you. So I just want to tell my audience. I go in, and I look, and I say, and first I look, I go, yeah, okay, I see salads, I see the deli, and I'm looking around, and it wasn't until I met, until I talked to Jimmy, that I find out, no, he's cooking too. He's doing his own thing. So what I wanted to have, Jimmy, come on and tell us about your background and why you came there, and then we'll talk about what you're cooking up.
Well, my name is Jim Clayback. I'm originally from Bayshore, New York. When I was about 16 years old, my dad told me to go out and get a job, and I got a job at Friendly's at the local mall. And I was a dishwasher for a couple of months. They needed some help in the kitchen, so they asked me if I wanted to cook, and I cooked, and I loved it. And since then, I've worked at a slew of restaurants out in Long Island and one in Manhattan, and now I'm taking on this new project.
And, like, when you were working at the other restaurants, what were you, you know, what kind of positions were you holding?
I mean, that was a range of things. I got to a level on Long Island where I was an executive chef and I was running the kitchen, so I needed to challenge myself. And I came out to Manhattan and I actually downgraded myself completely to a line cook so I could learn, you know, a new way of doing things and, you know, get my experience from real chefs in the city.
So, and what made you decide to... To take a job here at the cafe?
Well, basically, you know, Mike is the brother of one of my very good friends for a long time, and I've done events for them in the past with a catering company that I used to own, and it went over well, so they asked me to come on originally just to do a couple of specials a week. But then I started helping them, you know, getting their orders together and stuff like that. And eventually they asked me to come on, you know, to work at the cafe.
So when you got the job, I understand that you we were chatting and you said, like, this is kind of what you really want because, well, you're your own boss. You get to make up whatever you want to cook.
Well, basically how it all started is Mike's got some really great ideas. You know, he's got a real creative personality when it comes to the food. And basically he'll present me with an idea and he'll say, Jim, I really want to make this, but, you know, I don't know how to make it work. You know,
right.
He had a sriracha turkey burger on the menu, which is one of our top-selling items. And, you know, he said, I really want to make this, but I haven't made it before. You know, he had made sriracha tacos or something like that, and he said it was awesome, and he wanted to try it in a burger. So, you know, I went up from my knowledge and created a recipe for it, and it's one of the best-selling things. So me and Mike together, we make, you know, random ideas come to life.
Well, describe that burger. Like, what's in it, and, you know, you don't have to give the amounts of the details. What's in there?
Well, basically what we do is we take fresh ground turkey, and we mix it up with some kosher salt and coarse ground black pepper, some garlic and some onion, and then we throw some hot spicy sriracha sauce in there, mix it up.
What is sriracha sauce?
Rooster sauce.
I don't know.
Yeah, the rooster sauce. It's unmistakable. It's in a bottle with a green top, and there's a huge rooster on the front of it. It's a Japanese hot sauce made from the puree of red chilies.
Oh, okay. This
if you've ever had a spicy tuna roll, that's what gives the spice to the spicy tuna roll.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've had that. Okay. So it's spicy, but not like it's going to blow your mouth out.
Well, we have
depends on how much you put on.
We have different levels. You know, the customers order their burgers, and everything is made to order. So it's not a little spice.
You're fading.
Or no spice.
Are you talking into your phone?
Hello?
Yeah, I'm losing you.
Yeah, I think we're losing him. Are we losing him?
I can hear you.
Yeah, you can hear me. I can hear you.
You can hear me?
Yeah.
We're back in business.
All right.
Okay. Both of you?
Yep.
I can hear you.
All right. So you were saying, you know,
basically the customer, everybody's got a different palate, and you want to be able to give everybody the kind of experience they want to have. So, you know, we have people that come in and they order really hot, you know, extra spicy, and then we get people that come in and they want, you know, like a drop of sauce in there, and we have people that don't want it spicy at all. You know, it's a matter of preference. And your burger is made to order, so it doesn't really matter how much sauce you want. We'd be happy to accommodate.
Well, the thing I had noticed, which, and I have to say it surprised me because I don't think a lot of places kind of do that. I was, I was like watching Michael cook. I said, look at that. It's not like taking a patty out of the refrigerator. He's actually taking the meat and making it into a patty to make the burger.
That's right. That's one of the things that we're most proud of. All of our meat is fresh, never frozen, 100% USDA Black Angus.
And that really impressed me. And then I noticed that, and just, it, I mean, I was trying to observe a bit. It looked like that you were taking, like, your spice mixture, putting it on the grill, and putting the patty on top of it. Is that what I saw?
No.
As opposed to? No?
We'll just mix the spice mixture into, you know, into the ground beef or turkey.
Oh, okay.
Well, basically what you do is you start out with the preliminary seasoning on the burger, and then you sprinkle just a little bit of it on the grill for the bun. Because when you grill the bun,
got
you
it. Okay. That's
the flavors and, you know, everything. You got to add flavor to everything.
So let's just say, hey, listen, I'm on a low-sodium diet. Can you put in any salt? You can do that, right?
Absolutely. You know, the meat is not seasoned before you order it. It's not patted before you order it. You know, when you order your burger, we take your meat and put it in a bowl and we season it your way, make a burger out of it, and cook it for you.
Okay, so I can even say, listen, don't even season it. Just, you know, I'll put on whatever I want, the salt, the pepper, the ketchup, or whatever I'm going to do, right? I could do that.
Yeah, you could get any level, you know, that you want. You could get it with the works. You could order from one of the great burgers that Mike created that are on our regular menu. Or, you know, you could make your own burger. You could get it with nothing. You could get it with everything. It's
right.
Really whatever you want.
Yeah, we got the whole salad bar there, so people could top it with whatever you want. Like, I can't say I would put artichokes on a burger, but it's there if you want it.
Yeah, right.
Yesterday, you know, I made a burger with black beans, red onions, salsa, avocados. You know, people make their own creations there, and the possibilities are endless. From the eggs, burgers.
Wow.
You want.
I got to do that. The next time I come in, I'm going to do a create my own burger.
Create your own burger, your own omelet, whatever you like.
I think that's going to be pretty cool to do that. The comment, by the way, the comment I want to make about this is that, and this will never happen, like if you go into a diner, that the hamburger, just like if you got just a plain hamburger, that it's only $3.50. I mean, if people think about, you know, you're doing okay if you go to a fast food place and it's a buck or whatever kind of thing. No way. I mean, there's absolutely no comparison. In terms of ounces, approximately how many ounces is the burger prior to cooking?
It's about a 10-ounce patty.
Okay. So, I mean, you're getting good stuff, you know, getting fresh stuff and whatever. And honestly, I mean, like, you know, it sounds so odd. I mean, it's that I can look at it at this point and say $3.50 is cheap for a hamburger. But it's amazing of what's, you know, in terms of the economy, of what people charge for a burger.
Well, basically the position we're in here is that we want to give people a good product, and we could go ahead and charge $12 for that hamburger.
Right.
In all, you know, in all fairness. I mean, I've worked in places that have had a $26 hamburger that's made
right,
out of the
and I, yeah.
that you ate yesterday. And there's no reason for it because I can please 25 more people a day because they can't afford the $12 hamburger, but they can afford our $5 hamburger.
Right. That's why, yeah, that's why I was quite surprised. And, well, what did I have? I think I had the Swiss Delight.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
It's our 10-ounce burger with bacon, Swiss cheese, and honey mustard.
Yeah, not the best thing for a low-sodium diet, but I just wanted to try it. I won't do it again. I'll promise my chiropractor I won't do it again. But I really had to, like, taste, you know, something like that. And also, the other thing I want to get in, the second thing I want to get into is the soups. Now, okay, here was the thing, my preconceived thing was, yeah, they probably open up a can of soup, reconstituted, and, you know, the whole bit. But you're making your own soups. That's
yes,
so
ma'am.
Cool.
Yeah, we had another chef that was helping us out for a while when we were just getting started. But, you know, once we got the ball rolling and all the systems in set and in place, I didn't find it too hard to be making my own soups, and I really love to make soups, so I'm happy that I can be doing that.
And the one I had, it was a tomato soup? Is that what it was?
Yeah, that was the creamy tomato bisque.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I wouldn't call it tomato soup. I would have to call it tomato bisque. And the difference is, I mean, it's when you do a bisque, you're adding a lot more things into it. It's not just a plain tomato soup. And it had a little kick to it.
Yeah,
the red pepper flake. Yeah,
I mean, I like to add just a little bit of a spice to most of the things I do. And most of the time, you can't really taste it. But it's there, and it makes a difference in the dish.
But I'm also assuming that in terms of the soups, I can't come in and say, you know, I want to have soup, but I can't have any salt. I mean, it's already made by the time I walk in.
Well, the soups are made in the morning time. I mean, I do make
right.
them every day, but they will be ready when you get there, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, do you ever do that, something like make sure you have a soup that if somebody, you know, is on a low sodium or things like that, or you just...
Yeah, I mean, we pretty much cater to all customers. We have people that can't eat mayonnaise, you know, because of their cholesterol issues. So what I've been doing is every week I've been coming out with a tuna salad that doesn't have any mayonnaise in it. I've done a Mediterranean tuna that has, you know, olives, artichokes, capers, and red onions, and it has a lemon olive oil vinaigrette. And this week we have... honey mustard tuna that has red and green peppers and poppy seeds and, you know, our house-made honey mustard vinaigrette.
Now, for just to give an idea, like, what soups did you have today?
Today we had a creamy broccoli and cheddar and beef barley.
So do you have, up to how many soups do you have a day? You have, I mean, do you do four or just always...
I try to keep two, but, you know, sometimes I'll feel ambitious and we might have upwards of four or maybe even five.
Oh, even five, huh?
Yeah.
What kind of, now just to get, like, what other kind of soups have you made? You know that by the time I'm done with this show, I'm going to go into the refrigerator and I have to grab something to eat. But and so will everybody else who's listening. Yeah. So, yeah, what ambitious soups have you come up with?
Well, I mean, we make all sorts of different soups. We have your classic chicken noodle, Manhattan and New England clam chowder. We got the broccoli and cheddar, beef barley. I've also gone into in the past. You know, I've made a carrot and ginger soup, cauliflower soup with gorgonzola cheese. You know, mushroom bisque with tarragon. Butternut squash soup with a spiced sour cream.
My favorite.
So,
you know, the possibilities are really endless with soup.
So I need to, like, call ahead and say, what soups do you have today before I come down there, huh?
Well, it's a good idea to check every day what kind of soups we have, because they're changing all the time. And if a customer requests a soup, there's a, you know, a 95% chance that it's going to get made.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even just the soups that are changing. You know, every day we have a hot food special that's going to change.
Oh yeah, we want to get into that now too. That was the other thing, because I went, okay, they got soups, they got hamburgers, and I all of a sudden checked this little board there, and I went, wow, and there's this list of specials, hot specials. So tell us, like, what you're cooking up with the hot specials.
Well, basically, you know, every day I try to have one special that's, of course, fresh and made to order. So if you want to come in and feel like you're in a restaurant type of a setting, you can do that. You know, and it's always a full, complete meal. We've done everything from meat to Caribbean jerk chicken, barbecue pulled pork. Go down the Italian end with tortellini Alfredo, penne alla vodka. I did a stuffed eggplant, rice balls, things like that.
What'd you have today? What did I miss?
Today we had spicy New Orleans style chicken with fresh chopped tomatoes and pepper jack cheese.
And just to give people an idea, what do you charge for your those kind of specials?
$6 or $7, depending on, you know, what we serve. You know, something like the pulled pork was very labor and time intensive. It takes about 14 hours to roast the pork shoulder the right way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you got to take that into account, and that might be $8 or $9, but
right.
We haven't had a special yet that was more than $10, and I don't especially plan on doing that.
Okay, just want to get this way people can, you know, like get an idea. If you're not walking in, it's, you know, it's a cafe, and you're not going to spend. What would you say the cap is about? Like 10 or so, something like that, on one particular item.
Usually for yourself. You know, a regular person is going to come and get lunch, you know, just for themselves. They're spending less than $10.
Yeah. I mean, it's, but I'm saying on any one particular item that you have there.
Any particular item really is not going to be more than about $8 or $9.
Okay. Just to give you an idea. Which is, and I have to say, it's a little more unusual, you know, because... you know, for what you got, I mean, the comparison between, and I have, I mean, I'm not going to even bother in terms of taste, but I mean, compared to, you go on the other side of Woodhaven Boulevard to that diner, and you know, it's amazing the prices they come up with for food that's not as good.
Well, you know what? Everyone's trying to make a buck, and the important thing is to put out the food that you know that people want to have.
Yes, that's true, at a reasonable price, too.
Right. Well, I mean, you can't charge an arm and a leg and expect to cater to everybody.
You know, it's one of the things I'm like, because I have the menu in front of me, to, you know, like, you, I looked, it says coffee or tea. A small coffee is $1. God, I don't know where you can get coffees anymore for a buck.
You know, when I was pricing that out and I put it at $1, We laughed a little bit, me and Mike, between ourselves, because you can't get anything for $1. Even at the 99-cent store, it's $1.08.
Yeah, you're right. It's true. But they never, you know, what's funny, these the 99-cent stores, they all say 99 cents and up. They all
right.
say that. You know, it's like, well, every place could do that. They could charge $1,300 for something. Well, it's one of the things that's plus.
Yeah.
You know? Also, I noticed, like, you know, a buttered bagel's $1.25. I mean, that's something. That's not bad. I mean, you can get, I'm looking at, like, if you got coffee and a bagel with butter, just to grab something like the, you know, at $2.25.
You're walking out for less than $3 and you get a breakfast.
Yeah. But the thing is, in terms of, I'm not, you know, pushing that, because in terms of the being inexpensive, what makes it better for you guys is that when you're getting the people who are working in the neighborhood and they say, let me get breakfast, let me get lunch, let me get a snack. You know, I don't feel like cooking tonight. Let me stop over there. It's inexpensive enough. Let me get something and take it home.
Yeah, we have a lot of people that are working in the area that grab stuff from us throughout the day. Some people are in there for breakfast and lunch. You know, we have this one family. It's a mom and her two kids. They come in every single afternoon, and they're always having soup, and they have some sandwiches or the hot food. And, you know, they have their dinner at the Independence Cafe every night.
That's great. That's, what about, let's catch it. Get you on desserts. Do you make any? Are you making any of your own desserts?
Actually, baking is not exactly my forte. We're working with a great bakery that I've been using for years. The guys, you know, I'm real close with the guys there, and they're taking care of us real well.
Yeah, we have breakfast pastries, like a lot of Danish muffins, some. Crumb cakes, but also we do get some very, very good cupcakes from them. The peanut butter cupcake. It doesn't stay on there on the shelves for long, and I have to work real hard so that the store can sell it rather than me eat it, because it's really good.
And are you getting your bagels from the same place, or you got a separate place for the bagels?
No, we're actually, our bagels are getting driven in every day by one of our employees. He's picking them up from this great place on Long Island. He worked with them for years also, and you really can't compare the bagels to any other bagels I've ever had. And I even made bagels myself, and these bagels were none.
Really? I'll have to take, what I have to do is I'm going to have to come in and do a tasting that I usually kind of do when I go to a restaurant. I do a tasting with the chef. I'll have to do that with you guys because I really want to push is that what I like about it is it's a very, and I have to call it, it's like, you don't know what you want to eat. You want American food, you know. And I say American food meaning it's already like it's sort of a mixture. It's not one
right.
particular cuisine. It's like I don't know what I want to eat. Let me go here and I don't want and let me choose something. But I want people to get that you're when they're choosing something, it's fresh, and it's good,
Well, the thing is, if people are at work or something, going out to eat, not everybody has the same taste. But the idea
right.
is you get a place that, someone say, let's go to lunch. Oh, let's go here because everyone can be satisfied with something with what's on our menu.
Right.
If someone wants a salad, they got it.
When you talk to me, you come in, you're not seeing. You're not seeing, just employees of the place. You're seeing Mike, you're seeing me, you're seeing Dan, who's a full-time employee there, and you're seeing Nicole, and we're going to take care of you. If you don't know what you want, we'll give you some suggestions, help you create something. I had a customer today that wanted my hot special, but she didn't want it with the potatoes. So I said, all right, how about you make it a sandwich? She's like, oh, you know what? That's a great idea. Make it a sandwich.
Yeah. You guys got a website?
Yes, we do.
The website, website's somewhat under construction. It's, it's functional, but, it's just somewhat, giving somewhat of a preview right now, but it's just www.theindependencecafe.com. And, it's just, pretty soon we'll get it going. That way you can just check the website to see what, the day's specials are, what soups are available, and actually see the menu. Hopefully, some point relatively soon, you might even be able to order through the website. We're not quite, we're a bit of a ways from there, but it would be great.
I personally love it when I could do that, especially when you're at work, when you don't have much time. You know, if you're on the computer, it looks like you're doing work, maybe you could order food, you know, a little keyboard and mouse action, and then you get your food. You know, we'd like to get that going.
So what they, I reported back, I did report back to the hair salon, and they said, oh, will they deliver? Like, will they bring it across the street? I said, yep. Now you don't have to worry, because no one has to go out with their hair all full of whatever and say, oh, wait, I need to get something to eat and then bring it back.
Right, yeah, it's actually funny because we did actually bring a delivery over to, I guess it wasn't that hair salon, but one of the other local hair salons the other day. It's funny because, you know, they're all busy. Everyone's got their hands full of hair or their hair up and can't really move. So it's nice to have a place, you know, walk something over to you.
Right. Well, I appreciate you guys calling in. And I'll be back there. As I said, Jimmy, I'm going to have to do, like, you know, my usual tasting with the chef kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd be happy to put something together for you.
Okay. Well, again, this is the Independence Cafe, which is connected to the Independence Residence Incorporated, a not-for-profit organization. And, best of luck to you guys. I hope you do well. Hey, you know what? It'll be another thing that I write about that'll bring people to the other side of Woodhaven Boulevard, as I call it.
Right. Exactly, the other side. Thanks for
Yeah, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Things are looking up on our side of Woodhaven Boulevard.
Huh?
Things are looking up on our side of Woodhaven Boulevard.
Yes, they are. Yeah, and with Mama Mina's, like, a couple of stores down, that was bringing people to. And that was, I'm glad about that.
Right, yeah. You know,
okay,
guys.
Yeah,
restaurants in the area.
Yeah. Okay, I'll see you guys soon.
All right, thanks all for having us.
Okay, take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's absolutely fabulous. Now that we talked about food, we're going to talk about animals. Oh, goodness gracious. I'm not going to even pause for a commercial. I got Rick Schwartz here. Hey, Rick.
How are you?
Okay, Safari Park, huh? I'm sorry I couldn't make it today. I was out last night. I went to Broadway to see How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Uh-huh.
I went to review the show. I, you know, every once in a while, I'm so glad when I get to review the shows. It's like you're dealing with PR companies that handle the press when they
right.
go to see the shows. And, you know, it's like you don't always get to see every show. And it was like, oh, my God, I got to see a show that's going to be such a smash hit. It was absolutely fabulous.
Well, great.
And it was And the thing about it, not only was the entire show great, but it was, I guess for people, it was kind of odd to see. I don't know if you know who Daniel Radcliffe is.
You may not know him
by name.
Well, I think we all know him mostly by his main character that he grew up as, right?
Yes.
Isn't that Harry Potter?
Yes.
Right.
And so to see him, and it's so, you know, and hear him speak, of course, there's no English accent.
Mm-hmm.
When he's speaking, and it was amazing his the choreography that he did. But the entire show was great. But anyway, so I was a little I wound up going to sleep very late, and then I been hanging out with the cold, and I said, all right. And then I thought, whoa, why don't I have you on the show?
Well, there you go.
The first
here I am.
Question is, what are you doing in New York to promote this?
Doing in New York?
Yeah.
Well, yes. I don't know if all your listeners are aware, but I'm an ambassador for the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park. And they are two separate facilities. The San Diego Zoo is been in existence since 1916 there in downtown San Diego by Balboa Park, very much, quite often actually compared to the beautiful Central Park here. And with that, San Diego Zoo itself is about 100 acres and, you know, filled with a wide variety of animal species from around the world. That said, the Safari Park is 1,800 acres, so you could basically fit 18 San Diego Zoos in there. It is about 35 miles north of the zoo, so they are two separate areas, and sometimes people don't realize
okay,
that.
Okay, so it doesn't abut the zoo at all. It's a whole completely
it is a whole
different thing from the zoo. I want people
different
to get that.
Yes, yes, they are completely different. They are both amazing experiences, but both experiences are also very unique unto themselves. You know, the zoo has more of a classic zoo urban feel. We have bioclimatic zones where you go into certain areas and suddenly you're immersed in the rainforest of Southeast Asia or the tropics of Africa or the plains of Africa, where the Safari Park itself is very much like literally the whole place going to Africa, except for you don't need a passport and you don't need to get shots. So it works out pretty well. And what I mean by that.
In other words, I don't have to take my malaria pills, huh?
Exactly. Exactly. Those can get to you, too, that's for sure. But the Safari Park, the enclosures there are anywhere from 40 to 60 acres. So, and that's just one enclosure, not the zoo. The zoo or the park itself is vastly larger. And the concept behind all this actually started in the 1960s, and when our director of the zoo at the time realized we needed to have some sort of successful breeding situation in the zoo environment, because he recognized that even that early in the 1960s, there were certain species in peril. And the only way that he really saw a way to prevent them from going extinct was to start actively working on keeping viable populations in the states and in zoos that have already been taking care of animals, and then be able to repopulate areas with these animals. And so that said, by the 1972, it opened to the public as the Wild Animal Park. And currently now it has the name Safari Park, because really we still do all the breeding for all these endangered species. We still do a lot of conservation around the world. We do all sorts of education, but we've also kind of integrated more of an adventure feel. So as a guest, there are a lot of different safari adventures you can choose from while you're going out there and enjoying looking at these animals and kind of being immersed, if you will, into their environment.
So before we get into the different experiences of the park or the ways you can do it, what mm-hmm. is, tell us, like, you know, what's your background and, like, how did you get into all this in the first place?
Well, you know, I do get that question, actually. It's like, well, how did you know, you first started wanting to work with animals? Myself, my background is as an animal trainer and as a zookeeper. I started being in the ambassador position about a year and a half ago for both the zoo and the Safari Park, which is a blessing, as I love sharing with people my passion of working with the animals and the conservation efforts that we put forward. But, you know, people always ask me, when did you really realize you first wanted to work with animals and do what you do? And I really couldn't say. I mean, the only answer I have for that really is, how did you know you first wanted to breathe? You know, you just came out
right.
and started doing it. It just was a part of what you did.
Well, say, for instance, like in terms of training animals, like what animals, like, have you gotten to train?
Oh, my goodness. That's a long list. Probably well over 30-some species of animals in my lifetime. I've had the pleasure of working with just about all sorts of, anything from ocelots, servals. I've worked with big cats before at other facilities, tigers and lions, et cetera, even a leopard. You know, smaller animals like the very rare and endangered red panda, which is just a blessing to work with one of those animals because they are so amazing. Binturongs, fusa, a wide variety of birds, both parrots and birds of prey, owls, hawks, eagles, reptiles, snakes, lizards, you know, the list goes on and on. And I've been doing this for most of my life, ever since I got out of college. Just been always working around animals and with animals. And I've had the pleasure of being with the San Diego Zoo and Safari Park for over 10 years now. So it's one of those things where it's just always been a part of my life, and I just feel so blessed to do it for a living.
So in other words, this is all up close when you say training. You're touching them, you're petting them, you're, you know.
Well, it depends. You know, every animal is different, and some animals, they don't like to be pet. It's not their nature. These are not domesticated animals
right.
by any means, although we do work hands-on with many species. It's a lot of training that goes behind that. These aren't tame,
mm-hmm.
they're trained, is what we like to say, in the sense they're conditioned to work with us. Some animal species are solitary by nature, and touch to them actually might be a threat, and we have to know that about the species to successfully work with it. As far as the larger animals that I've worked with, it's all been what we refer to as protective contact. In other words, I'm not actually physically in there with the tiger or physically in there with the lion. It's through a protected area where the animal can't get to me and I can't get to them, which does challenge me as a trainer because I have to learn how to communicate with that animal to get it to do what I would like it to do and positively reinforce it. Because if it chooses not to, it can simply walk away from the training session and there's nothing I can do about it. You know, it is not all just sitting around hugging and cuddling and petting these animals.
Right, yeah.
It's a form of behavior work.
I was at a zoo in Texas, and I was watching a trainer, and so she was like, the fence was in between her and an orangutan.
Mm-hmm.
And what she was doing was, the training was involved being able to, like, she's pointing or just, like, almost touching so that the orangutan would extend, let's say, that part of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to, like, in case they needed to, you know, give them a shot or whatever, or to check
right.
them or, you know, things like
Certainly.
That.
Certainly, yeah. Many species of animals have similar ailments to us, so you might need to give them a shot or maybe take a blood sample. It's not uncommon for some species and some individual animals. Maybe you might get something like diabetes where you need to do blood samples and insulin shots, things of that nature. So it's much easier if you can train the animal to present an arm or a leg and sit still for that without having to restrain them, which can be very stressful for the animal and the keeper both. So we do the very similar training to that, yes, where it's all positive reinforcement to help with any medical things or health things or just basic care. We don't do really a lot of training for, you know, say, tricks or showmanship. When we have our animals trained to come out and work within the public areas, it's for educational purposes. We don't want to hit people over the head with education. We want them to have a really good time when they come to our facility, into the safari park. But we do want them to learn what's going on with this species, what's going on with their habitat, what they can do in their own life to maybe partake in helping out in conservation, or if they want to even get more involved in some of our conservation programs that we have worldwide. So it's a great opportunity for everyone.
So in other words, this isn't a place where you're going to see animal shows.
Well, we do have some programs that show
what I mean,
the
program,
natural adaptations.
I mean, like, you know, you're not going to, like, you know, like if you go to a SeaWorld or something in the...
Well, yeah, know. In the sense of that it's not just tricks, but a lot... We do have two sit-down shows, and they allow our trainers to have a moment with our guests there to show the natural adaptations. So we have some animals that do some wonderful climbing, some pre-flight birds that they can see the adaptations of flight
right.
and things of that nature. But they are geared more towards the conservation message. They are fun. We try to make it interactive because, again, no one wants to sit there and be lectured to, that's for sure. But as you leave that theater area, you've definitely learned a lot about these individual animals and what's going on with them in the wild. You know, and something we're introducing at the safari park this summer is what we refer to as our Cheetah Run Safari. And the importance of this is, you know, I can sit here and tell you that, you know, cheetahs are the fastest land mammal. They can reach 70 miles an hour. They can get up to 60 miles an hour in three steps, which I can't even really wrap my head around getting that fast in three steps, but it's true. But now imagine if you can actually see that happening right in front of you, you know, just 10 meters away from you. You can actually hear that animal running by and see it happening right there. Well,
wow.
At Cheetah Run Safari, we have a couple of cheetahs that are trained to run a straight, it's about 100 meters, give or take, and it's a straight line. They chase a lure, and it gives our guests the opportunity to listen to our keepers talk about our training, talk about the cheetah and some of the cheetah's adaptations, and then actually experience that animal running full speed right in front of them.
Is anybody putting down money and betting on which cheetah is going to go faster?
Oh, we don't race the cheetahs. No, it's a one at a time. It's a one at a time ordeal. We're not going to race them.
The cheetahs are probably going, oh, there's those people again. All right, it's your turn, and you better pick up speed in 3 seconds. You know that.
Yeah, they probably keep track themselves. Yeah.
And by the way, I have an insignia photo of myself that I use, and it's of me holding a 3-month-old lion cub in my arm.
Oh, my goodness.
I had gone to South Africa And they had, it was like, they called it a lion park, I guess. And apparently, I think like these were rescued animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess they might have bred or something. So they had them of all different stages. So in one particular area, I mean, there was a three-month-old and a six-month-old. After 6 months, you don't pet them anymore.
Right.
You don't pick them up after 6 months. But they had that, and it was like, I just couldn't believe I was just holding this thing, and it's like meowing, and like, I know, like, oh my God, look how cute. But
yeah.
I
was going to say, I can hear in your voice how much that moment meant to you. I mean, that moment not only meant a lot to you, and I can hear in your voice, but so much so that you're using that picture as your icon on your site, and you know, as your thing, and that's that kind of moment. That is a moment that can change people's lives. That's the moment that we start to see people start to go, you know what, I want to do something for conservation also. I want to do something for this species. They go home and tell their family about that experience, and that's exactly what we want our guests to go through. Like I said, I've been doing this for a very long time, and it is such a pleasure for me when working with these animals and talking to our guests about them in our, you know, our keeper talks and our trainer talks, and seeing them get up close and personal and seeing in their eyes the excitement for being there, the vast desire for more knowledge and asking me all these questions, that moment we kind of refer to as that aha moment, that the moment that you get drawn in. You know, you can look on TV at baby lions, like, you know, or you can be involved with doing something with them like you did. And that's going to be a vastly different experience, and that's what we want to offer our guests.
Now, you brought in three animals to New York. Tell us what you brought in.
Well, yesterday I flew into New York with our ground boa. She's about 7 feet long and about 30-some pounds, and she's an African species from the island of Madagascar, to be specific. Actually, gorgeous colorations. We also brought in an animal called a rock hyrax. And the best description
that's
I can
the
give,
one I want. That's the one I want to talk about, because I went,
okay,
and what?
Yeah, we'll come back to him. I'll tell you everyone who's here, and then we'll come back to him. How's that sound?
Okay.
Well, so the rock hyrax, which I can best describe, is just kind of like a fluffy football with legs, about that size. He's about 10 pounds.
I was
just cute as can be. And then we also brought a species of owl called a milky eagle owl, also an African species. They are the third largest owl in the world, the largest owl species in Africa, and they're just gorgeous, gorgeous birds. This one was hatched and raised in a zoo and has been with us since he was probably just about 2 months old. He's just a lovely animal to work with, very charming, and just you get drawn to him. He's so beautiful. And then today, this evening, We flew in two more trainers with our cheetah. So what we're doing here in New York is we're kind of promoting up all the different things at the Safari Park and how it is different than the San Diego Zoo. All these animals that are with me the next couple days are from the Safari Park. And we'll be doing a news show tomorrow morning on Fox 5 for New York residents, Good Day New York. And then on Saturday morning, we'll be on the CBS Early Show, the national morning show there for the weekend. So that's what we're doing here, and that's all the animals that we brought with us.
So if I'm able to schlep in tomorrow into Manhattan to meet you, I'll be able to. I have this whole thing. I mean, my friends are always saying, trying to explain to me, Merle, they're not domesticated. You can't pet every single animal you see.
That's
but
correct.
But that's my reaction is – oh, I want to go over and pet it. I just can't.
Of course.
Like that, you know, everything, anything.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's very much a human reaction. We see something that we like, we're drawn to it, we want to touch it. But that's how we investigate our environment. We kind of lose that sometimes as far as realizing that's how we connect to things, not just by seeing it, but sometimes by touching it too. So it's a natural desire. It's a natural response that you're feeling that, oh, I want to go and pet that. You know, and unfortunately, though, a lot of these animals, because they are not domestic, they are trained to work with us, they don't trust everyone they don't know. They trust the people that they've worked with on a daily basis since they were born. That's their trainers and their keepers. People they don't know, it doesn't make sense to them why you would want to approach them and why you would want to touch them. They just don't have that same mindset as a domesticated animal. But the animals that can be touched or can be closely approached, we definitely have that interaction for, I guess. It's just not every animal that can be worked with that way. And we respect what our animals respond best to. We don't want to put them in situations that they wouldn't be comfortable.
Well, you're bringing in a cheetah. I mean, it's not like I can... The cheetah's going to let me touch it, will it?
That's correct. Unfortunately, the cheetah is not an animal that we have people pet.
Yeah, but
he's
it's
a big
like,
boy. He's about 110 pounds, and he's 9 years old, and he's very, very comfortable with his trainers. It's an amazing relationship to just see that bond that they have. But he's a little leery of people that he doesn't know. Again, kind of that mindset of, why would you want to approach me? I don't know who you are.
Yeah, that's true. So it's not like I could say, oh, I'll meet you tomorrow, and I can get a photo with the cheetah, huh?
No, we have a very tight schedule with our media visits that we're doing, and so I'm not sure if we'd be able to work that out. That's something maybe you'd be able to contact some of our representatives and see if we could somehow squeeze that in the schedule.
Okay, I'll just, we'll wait till I come out to the safari park.
Certainly, yeah, you come out that way, we'll make sure you get a chance to see some animals. I mean, that's what we're all about, is connecting people to wildlife and conservation, so we could definitely have that happen.
So I just want to get into this what is it called, a Hyrax?
The Hyrax, yes.
Yeah, tell us about this.
Okay, so because we're on radio here, the best I can do is kind of paint a picture with my words, so I'll do my best. First of all, imagine sort of the shape of a regulation football.
Right.
And give it a nice little fuzzy coat that all kind of lays back, a cute little black nose and some rounded ears, and then some stubby little legs. And it weighs about 10 pounds. And now here's the thing that's going to throw everybody off. Closest living relative of the Hyrax, believe it or not, is the elephant. Now, I just told you that it's only 10 pounds, about the size of a football. So it's very hard for people to believe that, but it's true. They don't have a trunk, but what makes them distantly related is when scientists classify animals, they use, for taxonomy, they use the bone structure and dentition, or tooth structure, of the animals. And what they have found through fossil records is that the ancient Hyrax and ancient elephants were very close in size. And the families they come from were very diverse in size, from much smaller elephants than what we have today and much larger. And also the rock Hyrax was the largest one they have on fossil record, was about the size of an ox. So much, much larger than today's Hyrax. That being the case, what makes them related is the bone structure of the legs and feet are exactly the same, except for just much smaller on the Hyrax, of course. And then the dentition and the lower jaw structure is also very parallel. So there are a lot of relations there, but over time, they have gotten very vast, and their differences in the families have changed a bit in size.
If you were actually, I mean, I don't know if you can touch it. Can you touch it? I mean,
I've raised two that we use for our programs, and so the one we have here and his brother I work with, and so I'm able to touch them and work with them, yes.
If I'm touching it, what would you compare the fur to? What animal?
I would say probably just a little bit coarser than maybe a house cat's fur, a short-haired domestic cat. Maybe a little bit coarser, but what's also unique then sporadically throughout the coat, they have very thick, long hair that almost look like whiskers. It's very sporadic, not covering the whole body, just here
right.
and there. And it looks and feels exactly like elephant hair. It's that thick, coarse, black hair. And they use that because they live in rock outcropping. So they use those hairs sort of as touch-sensitive feelers, similar to what whiskers are on the face of a cat or a dog. But this one has it throughout its body, and it helps it kind of navigate through the rock outcroppings of the areas that are referred to as kopjes in Africa.
What does it eat?
Well, it is a strict herbivore. Just like the elephant loves leafy greens, depending upon the season, of course, and what's available, but they're a strict herbivore. So depending on the season, if it's after the rainy season, they'll eat grasses and freshly sprouted plants. Drier season, they tend to try and go for leaves of trees that are still doing well, even though it's a bit drier in the season. So it just depends really on the season and what's available. What's also interesting, too, that is kind of a parallel to the elephant, is their behavior, which I find is very interesting because, you know, science has drawn the lines with the taxonomy and the hard facts and evidence that they can see there in the bones. But when you observe them behaviorally, you notice there's a matriarchal system, just like with elephants. There is a female that's in charge of the group. If you're a female and you're born into the group, you'll probably stay with the group, just like with elephants. And if you're a male, once you become mature, you'll probably split off and join what's called a bachelor group or bachelor herd. We see this parallel behavior in elephants. So very interesting to see that. You don't see that usually in other mammal species to this degree, being so close like these two are.
So in other words, it's classified as a mammal.
Yes, it is a mammal. Uh-huh.
Okay. Where, I mean, if now, when I was in South Africa, I saw, you know, animals like, I would say, what is that thing, or what a kind
right.
of thing, you know. Is this, where would you find this particular animal?
Sure. There are three types of hyrax. There's a rock hyrax, which we have with us here in New York. And there's a tree hyrax and bush hyrax. They all look very close to the same, a little bit different in size and a little bit different in coloration, but not drastic by any means. Those three different species of hyrax can be found all the way from South Africa, probably in similar areas where you were, as far north as the Middle East and Lebanon. And all throughout, where you wouldn't find them is going to be incredibly dry desert, like the Sahara Desert, where it's just dry sand plains and dunes.
Right.
Wouldn't find them there, and you wouldn't find them in the rainforested areas around the Congo. But your more arid type areas that do have rock outcroppings for them to hide in, and what we refer to as sort of a scrub type environment, which is a low growing type trees or large shrubs, that type of environment, they do quite well in that.
Would you find them like in the United States then, or no?
No. Not in the United States, strictly Africa and the Middle East. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you, at a zoo, I suppose. we have to
yeah.
have a safari park.
that's true. I was curious because one of the things that you find that you don't find in the United States are like, you know, there are a lot of animals you don't find in the United States. And I kind of wonder, like, you know, I guess there is no specific areas really that unless you're talking like a wolf or, you know, things like that, where you can find what I would say more interesting species of animals. I mean, you ain't gonna find a meerkat.
Yeah, well, it's true. That's true. You know, there are different diverse species throughout the world, and man has played a large role in the distribution and what's really around us. I mean, you cited the wolf as being an example of something somewhat exotic, you know, and I would agree. I would agree mountain lions and cougars also. I think there are things like the badger or the wolverine, which are very unique and exotic animals that we do have here in the United States, but their numbers are low. And
right.
if you look at a lot of the field guide work that Lewis and Clark did when they were first really, if you will, starting to cut across America with their exploration, these animals were abundant. They were thriving, and they were throughout the United States quite well. You know, as man moves across the United States in our migration west, we did change the landscape quite a bit to make sure it suited us and so we could survive. And so with
right.
that, we saw
yeah.
some change in the natural habitats and natural wildlife. So I think today that's why we don't see quite as much as what we consider exotic animals here native to the United States, where, you know, honestly, though, some people, I mean, and myself included, would argue that, you know, things like skunks and raccoons are unique, you know, and not just the bigger flora and fauna, such as the wolf and the cougar. There's a lot of great, wonderful wildlife throughout the U.S. still. It just maybe in smaller pockets here and there.
Yeah. Well, the next thing I want to get into is there are different experiences of the park that you could have.
Yes, there are.
I want to go through each of them. First is the tram. Tell us about what the tram does,
well,
how that works.
Yeah, you know, if you just want to come and spend a relaxing day, this is the best way to do it. You come in, and for your admission, you also get our basically referred to as our African tram experience. And really, that is just pretty much what it sounds like. It's a guided tour. The tram is about 30 to 40 minutes long as far as the ride goes. You're in there with a group of people, and the operator who drives you gives you a lovely tour of our very large facility. Like I mentioned, it's about 1,800 acres. Only about 900 of it really is dedicated to our enclosures and our African animals. The other 900 has been set aside to be not touched, because some people don't realize this. San Diego County is one of the most diverse plant and animal counties in the United States. And so we've set it's pretty amazing. We've set aside that 900 acres to be untouched as a natural preserve and allows us to also study our natural habitat that we have right in our own backyard, which is pretty amazing. But that tram ride, it's an opportunity for you to really get a wonderful view. I was saying earlier, a lot of our enclosures are anywhere from 40 to 60 acres, and these are multi-species enclosures. You see then, because of this, natural behaviors you would see if you were on safari in Africa, whether it's the animals behaving a certain way during breeding season or a mom who already has a youngster, or perhaps maybe how herds interact with different species of animals. And the guide will point these things out to you as you go along. Our guides are awesome. They really have studied a lot. They know, actually, most of the animals on site as individuals because they've worked there long enough. They can say, okay, well, this one has a history of doing this, or usually that one this time of day is hiding over there, and sure enough, there it is. So it's a really great experience, and, you know, it's one of those things where if you maybe have, you know, you're going there with your family, you've got a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old, the African tram tour is perfect for the whole family to really enjoy as a group. And also then there's a lot of walking experiences, too. The next, really, I think.
So you're getting. So in other words, does the tram stop and you can get off and look closer or whatever?
No, it's a continuous ride, and you stay seated the whole time. You stay in the tram the whole time.
But it'll stop like the photos.
Sure, it'll slow down and stop at certain points, and maybe if the driver is talking about, let's say, a particular giraffe who's showing a certain unique behavior. You would have the opportunity to stop and take a photo and listen to what the driver is saying about that. Being the case, though, it is, you're on the perimeter of the field enclosures. You're not actually going deep inside, if you will.
Right.
But we do have our caravan safari.
That's the second one I wanted to get into, that's like.
It is.
Am I getting that the caravan is more like when I did the game tours in South Africa?
I think so. Yeah, you know, it's very similar in the sense that it's a large truck. It's a flatbed truck with railing around it, of course. There's some bench seats along the perimeter of that, and there's a canopy over the top. And you go out there. There's a guide in the back of the truck with you, and there's a driver, of course. And you actually do go into the field exhibits. And if the animals want to approach, they will. There's also an opportunity. Usually the guide will have a few leaves of acacia with them, which is the giraffe's favorite tree and a natural part of their diet. And that will then, of course, encourage the giraffes to come investigate. And it's a wonderful photo op for you. And, I mean, holy cow, the eyes of the giraffe, because they get so close, you can look them right in the eye. I've done this many times, but I still I don't get enough of it. I love it, absolutely love it. They're so beautiful. And it's just, and of course, the truck will stop and allow for everyone to have this unique opportunity to really kind of have your moment to connect. And with that, too, if the rhinos show any interest, we have some beautiful rhinos that, you know, will approach also, and you can do some feeding with them, too, from the back of the truck. And, again, it's that opportunity. Where else would you get the chance to actually see a rhino that close?
Yeah.
And be able to feed them a little treat of some sort, and then maybe pet them on the nose if they want to stick around for it, too. So it's really an outstanding opportunity as you travel through. And that said, too, the driver and the guide, it's not just giraffe and rhinos. There's other animals they can point out, maybe show you where a mother has tucked her young, you know, to keep it safe or whatever the case may be.
Right. I also, when I was at that zoo, I got to feed the giraffes. And as the giraffe was eating from my hand, I was petting its face. And it allowed me to pet it. And I was like, oh, look at that. I'm training it.
exactly.
Now the next thing I want to get into then is the Segway. And where does that go that makes it any different from, you know, the other places, the other way, or the tram or whatever?
Well, yes, there the Segway tour, we refer to as our rolling safari, is a very unique and different tour. You know, the large tram tour, like I said, it's a large tram with a guide, and you sit and you listen and you see what they show you. The photo caravan tour, or the caravan tour we just talked about, a little bit different. You're still with a large group of people. You have one guide with you. You have that interaction opportunity. what's really unique to me when I've done the Rolling Safari, and I've noticed other people say too, because the segues are so quiet and you are on a separate path that is just for the segue tour and also for what we call our cart tour, which is a smaller electric cart. And it's usually anywhere from 6 to 10 guests and then 2 guides. So the ratio of your guides to guests on a segue tour is... makes it, I don't know, a little more intimate. It really gives you the opportunity to ask questions, not just listen to someone telling you what you're seeing. And what's really unique, too, is they will stop the Rolling Safari, and you will get off the Segway, and you will get as close as you can to the perimeter to take pictures and talk about what you're looking at and enjoy how quiet it is out there. And with that smaller, intimate group, you know, everyone kind of appreciates that hushed, natural quiet that you hear out there in the middle of those exhibits. So it's very unique unto itself that way, and a very special way, really, to kind of travel around and see all the different sites out there.
So it's taking a different, in other words, it's not going along where the tram goes. It's going as a whole separate.
Yes, it has its own special path. Like I said, we do have also more intimate cart tours, so segues really aren't your thing because it does require, you know, a little bit of balance and understanding of how to work one of those. Let's say you're out there with your grandparents, or let's say, you know, you hurt your ankle and so you can't use the Segway. We have these cart tours that, again, it's anywhere from 7 to 10 people on a very fancy kind of looking electric cart, and you're there with a guide who takes you on that same trail. And, again, it's the same thing, much more intimate, much quieter. You'll stop and get off and look and talk about the different animals and have the opportunity to ask questions of that guide that you normally may not be able to get quite that intimate with in a larger tram tour.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Okay.
Yeah,
then
next... And with the cart tours, too, you have the opportunity to do some meet and greets with some animals at other parts of the facility.
Now, what about, there's something regarding a balloon? Did I catch something? Tell me about that.
Well, you know, it was inspired by the fact that it's not uncommon in South Africa and other of the game reserves to have hot air balloon opportunities to rise above quietly and see the animals from the height of those balloons. Well, of course, we can't launch hot air balloons all day long. That just wouldn't work. But we were able to get together with a company who has a very large helium balloon with a very large basket below it that is much, much larger than what you would imagine in your head as far as the standard hot air balloons. And with that, it's tethered. So it goes. There's an electronic winch that allows it to go very high up and gives you a wonderful, beautiful overview of the entire park and everything around. And, the whole area is called San Francisco Valley, which is just gorgeous out on the outskirts of San Diego. And it's a beautiful view, and you go up there and you hang out for a while, you take pictures and just take it all in and then slowly come back down.
Wow. Okay, then the next one. The zip line.
Yes, this is the one that puts
adventure.
Where did
this take you? From what point to what point that you're seeing?
Well, it literally takes you across the top of a couple of our enclosures. Like I said, the whole area is well over 1,800 acres, and so this zip line we refer to as our flight line runs 2/3 of a mile from beginning to end. It's the longest zip line available in the contiguous United States. So it is very, very beautiful. Some people look at it initially and they're like, oh, my gosh, you could never do that. It is very high off the ground. But, again, it's one of those moments that when you're in the middle of it and you're gliding along, just kind of feeling the breeze and the wind in your hair, and you look around, and it's an amazing experience and view to really be soaring up there like a bird with the Sawyer Duvernay flight line. And part of that, too, it's a bit of a drive up to the top of the hill where you launch from, and we use that time to talk a lot about our condor conservation, and because a lot of the funds generated from Flightline Experience goes to condor conservation directly. So guests know not only they paying some money to have some fun, but we're able as a nonprofit organization to make sure a lot of this money goes right back into our mission statement, right back into our conservation efforts, and it does make a difference.
So, in other words, in terms of the zip line, it's a one-shot. You're not going from one spot to another to another.
Correct. Yeah, what you do is you go through a bit of a training, runs maybe 20 minutes or so with your group, and then you go into what we call our fledgling line, which is a much shorter zip line, just so you have the experience of what takeoff and landing feels like. And then you all get into the truck, and then you go all the way up to the very top of the hill, and that's your big long. It takes almost 3 minutes really to go from point A to point B when you're on the flight line. So you reach speeds of 40 miles an hour, give or take, and yeah, a good 3 minutes of doing that.
Yeah. Okay. I have seen
people who are a little concerned of heights come off that thing with a grin from ear to ear asking, can I please go do it again? It is a unique experience. And you're not just strapped into a harness. It's almost like you're in a seated hammock. It's actually very comfortable. You don't have to hold on. You don't have to worry about your grip. You just sit back and enjoy. They teach you exactly how to make the landing, and it is so much fun.
I did this in California,
mm-hmm.
a zip line, and I am absolutely afraid of heights. What I had to deal with, I mean, before I actually did the zip itself, the panic that I went through.
Oh, no.
to deal with this, and finally, because, like, I just, like, I got to a point, I said, oh, my God, I can't do it. Can I back out? Now, I had somebody with me who's now going to take the video of this, so I have this. And the guy said, no, get ahead. You could, you know. And what I wound up doing, he says, okay, just sit back. In other words, instead of sitting up, I sat as if I was in a, what do you call it? The chair, like the
recliner,
like a recliner.
Yeah.
And what happened is that what I did is I did it that way. So instead of looking down, I was kind of looking up, because what I needed to get was a sense of what does it feel like to be in this thing.
Right.
But once I got that taken care of, then I looked and I said, okay, the next time I can do this and I can look, because I already got what the thing feels like.
Yeah, exactly.
And it wasn't that horrible.
Right, it isn't. And it's actually kind of nice, isn't it? It's kind of peaceful.
Yes, and it was fun. I mean, like, now, I mean, because I have to tell you, and like, people think I'm crazy, because when I say that I'm afraid of heights, I have gone up in one of those, and I call them soaring planes, and it's like there's a plane
you know, the
in front that's like with the plane in front has a bungee cord kind of thing.
Yeah, I've seen that before.
You know, and you go up and you get to a point and the bungee cord drops, you know, whatever. And and the pilot was there and he's, you know, and you're soaring. There's just no engine. And people say, I can't believe you do that. And I say, the guy who's flying the plane knows what he's doing. He don't want to die. I mean,
right, exactly.
I'm not concerned. I mean, at that point, I'm not concerned about the height at all. I'm okay when I'm enclosed. That's the whole thing.
Right.
If I'm enclosed in something, something's around me, something's holding me, I'm fine with the height. So, although I don't know that I'll do the zip line when I come. But
Fair enough. Well,
it's a thought.
I definitely want to encourage people, though, that are you know, listening or planning on coming out for travel. It is really a very unique opportunity to do that and be able to have that be a part of your safari adventure. And like I said, we do obviously want people to be aware of the conservation that is behind all that we do.
Sure.
So it's a great opportunity to learn about our condor program, too. Just briefly to touch on that, back in the 80s, there were only 22 of those birds left in the world. And the San Diego Zoo and U.S. Fish and Game and another facility, the L.A. Zoo, got together and decided that it was time to do something, because we did recognize that there was some, you know, human influence as to why the species was being lost. And now today, we are proud to say that there are nearly 400 birds in that population. And about half of that is flying free in the wild, propagating on their own today. So it is a wonderful program. It's still very active. You know, those birds aren't out of the woods yet, but they are coming along. And it's a great opportunity for our guests to get involved and support that.
Tell us, and the one other thing that I want to discuss, the last thing, is the overnight. Tell us about what the overnight is, Rick.
Yes. Well, now let me ask you something really quick before we talk about Roar and Snort. Did
sure.
you get the opportunity, when you were in South Africa, did you get the opportunity to actually sleep outdoors?
No. No,
well, let
me
tell you, you missed out. I've had the opportunity when I was in Botswana to actually camp out in the field. We were tracking elephants. And the symphony of sounds that you get to hear are amazing. Almost every species of animal has some sort of location call it does, either in the evening hours or the morning hours or somewhere in between all of that. And it is a very unique sound and experience. Well, our Roar and Snore program, you do camp out right there at our safari park. We have this beautiful campground set up. Everything as far as, you know, there are bunks and places to keep your gear, that sort of stuff. We offer a hot breakfast in the morning. And part of that, you're not just camping and hanging out and doing your own thing. It's a whole program. You get to learn about all the animals in the area that you'll be hearing and listening to. In the evening hours, our education staff shows up with some animals similar to some of the animals I have here in New York, and you get to do a meet and greet, ask questions, see them up close, get to learn about the individual personality of the animal, but also what's going on with the species over there in Africa. You camp very close to the elephants, so you hear them with their rumbles and their trumpets as the evening comes. As we go into night, there's those nighttime location calls from all those animals out there. And then in the morning hours, you usually wake up to the roar of the lion because the lion loves to do his location call, telling all the other lions in the world, this is my territory. And to hear that, really, like I said before, earlier in the conversation, it is a lot like being in Africa. Just you don't have to pay as much. You don't have to worry about the passport and the shots. So it's really a wonderful experience. And it's not over there. After you have a nice warm breakfast, our educators and guides will take you to one of the behind-the-scenes areas. And you get to see how the safari park kind of gets started first thing in the morning. What do the keepers do, and how is it to be a keeper or an animal trainer? And so it's a full experience from beginning to end.
Is it appropriate
for all ages, too, kids, adults,
seniors. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is it like a tent where you're sleeping on the ground or a tent where there's a cot?
There's a cot. And then there's different upgrades. You can get a full mattress. You know, just depends on what you want to have as part of your safari experience when you call in the booking station or book it online. There are several different options to choose from, just kind of like at a hotel, different upgrades you could ask for and things like that.
Wow, this is really cool. Yeah.
It is. It really is. And it's something to talk about. But, boy, when you go out there and experience it, it is so much fun. And a lot of families, you know, nothing against Disney, because I love Disneyland. I take my kid there, too, and it's great. But I do notice sometimes at certain adventure parks, you tend to notice that, you know, one parent will take the younger kid or younger two kids and the other parent takes the older kids and everyone kind of splits up. Everybody has a great time. Everyone has a lot of fun. But they had to go off and kind of do it separately in their own way. The really fun and unique thing about the safari park, the San Diego Zoo Safari Park, is that the whole family gets to stick together for the whole adventure because everything really is appropriate age for everyone. Everyone gets to enjoy the experience, point things out to each other, see the reaction of their brother or sister or their parents, you know, grandparents traveling with their grandkids. It works for everybody. So it's really a wonderful time.
What would you say minimum amount of time to spend?
Oh, my gosh, the whole day, of course. I couldn't imagine you would want to come and try and spend half a day there. Our hours in the non-summer season were usually open 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. In the summer season, we're open as late as 7 p.m., but depending upon what time of year you want to come out, you'd want to check our website for the hours. But definitely, bring comfortable shoes. Be prepared to spend the whole day there. You know, bring some sunscreen, because it is Southern California. We don't want you to get sunburned. And just plan on spending the whole day. In fact, you know, some families will purposely come out, maybe spend a week in San Diego, and they'll plan to spend 2 days. They'll come and do one or two of the safaris one day, and they come back the following day to do a different couple safaris. Or if you're a family that goes to Southern California more, you know, every year, you could come out 1 year, do one or two of the safaris, come back the next year, do two different safaris, same facility, same safari park, but completely different experience both years. So it's one of those things where you can come back time and time again and never experience the same thing twice.
Wow. So, is there like a, what is the like a basic admission to the park?
The basic admission is around $40, depending upon your age. I think it's $40 for 12 and above. And that's the basic admission, and that also includes the initial tram tour we were talking about. So that's all part of just get you in the door. And like I said, there's a few different shows and programs. When the Cheetah Run is up and going, that'll be in July. That'll be part of your admission also. So that's kind of your bare bones. And we kind of have what we call our booking station where you can then add on safaris.
Now,
so you can add on safaris from there as you progress and what you just say, oh, you know, actually I do want to do flight line. You have to use maybe somebody else going down it. So those things sometimes will book up fast, though, so we do recommend people maybe, you know, book their tours in advance.
Now, what about the food there? Are there restaurants or they're basically like little cafes to grab something to eat?
Well, the food there at the Safari Park is a kind of an eclectic mix. You can find just about anything that's going to please everybody in the family. Of course, there's the standard zoo fare, and by that I mean, you know, your hot pretzels and your popcorn and your sodas and all that. But there are sit-down areas, too. If more of a burger or even a veggie burger is your thing, we have one area that's got really, really good Mexican food. It's one of my favorite places to eat when I'm there. Great burritos. You know, and then, of course, there's pizza, too, chicken. You know, it just kind of depends on what your family members might like. But there are a variety of different places to eat. Or just grab a snack, maybe a quick ice cream bar or something like that. Whatever you need.
So I guess what I'm asking, there's no particular dining, you know, one particular restaurant where they serving like South African food or something like that.
No, nothing of that nature. We have, okay. I would say, three areas that you actually would go in, and it's more of kind of a cafeteria where.
Right.
It's not really appropriate to say cafeteria, but you're in a line and you kind of say, okay, I want this, and the other. And they prepare it then in that moment, and you get it on a tray
right.
And you pay at the end. And then there's sit-down area and table and whatnot for that also. But to say that it's actually a formal sit-down dining situation there at the Safari Park, no, there's not that.
Okay. And by the way, do they have some combination where you can go to the zoo and the Safari Park?
Oh, certainly.
There's an
opportunity that if you're either at the San Diego Zoo or the San Diego Zoo Safari Park and your intentions are to go visit both, there is an opportunity to buy in different passes that at a discount for both facilities, you know, if you want to go to visit both in your full vacation there. At that point, too, though, if you're a family that likes to go to Southern California more often than not, we would encourage maybe looking at the membership. Not only does that get you year-round access to both parks at any time that you want to show up, but also then you get our magazine newsletter and special discounts and things of that nature and updates as to what's going on. So that's something to look at, too, because it is actually a very smart move financially if you're planning on going to both parks more than once.
Yeah, a lot of times it is when these things happen. Especially if you like, if you're a resident,
it is really it's really a nice place, you know, and San Diego is so beautiful, so it's we do recognize that we are a destination point for many, many people, and we appreciate the support, you know, as far as from my perspective and what I do, we couldn't do this. We're a nonprofit organization, and we do what we do out of the support of those who visit us and the support of our members, and we definitely could not have the conservation efforts that we have across the globe or do the education outreach that we do with our animals if it wasn't for that ongoing support. So we do recognize that and greatly appreciate it.
So now you were saying before, you're going to be on TV tomorrow morning?
Yes, we are. Yeah, we'll be in New York's New York Fox 5, Good Day New York is the morning show there. And so we'll be
appearing. What time?
I don't have the exact time. I just know it'll be during the morning show. I've heard it might be around 9 o'clock.
Okay.
I'm going to speak for my paperwork. Maybe later in the 9 o'clock hour. So maybe tune in around 9:15 and then stay tuned in until you see us. Sometimes
and then you said
shows,
there was another one?
You know, yes, Saturday morning, we are going to be at the CBS early show, at the CBS studios there, and we are scheduled to be on around 8:30, maybe a little bit later, but again, these live shows, sometimes things change, so I'm hesitant to say, oh, we'll be on exactly then, and then, you know, something changes and you miss us, but yeah,
right.
We'll be on the CBS early show Saturday morning for national television, and we're very excited to be a part of that, and it sounds like they're very excited to have us, so it's going to be a lot of fun, really, really enjoy New York, I tell you, it's my third time here representing the zoo and the park, and It's just so much fun being here. And one last thing, too, just in case you miss it on TV, you can come to the New York Library on 42nd. We are doing a live presentation there with some of the animals, not all of them, because that will be kind of the end of our day. So I think that's on 42nd over by Bryant Park. It's the Children's Center at the public library there. And we will have some of the animals with us, and I'll be there, and we will be doing a live presentation. I believe it's free to the public. And so people can come down and ask questions and take pictures and get a glimpse of some of these beautiful animals visiting all the way from San Diego.
Wow. Approximately what time would that be?
That's going to be at 3 p.m.
Okay.
I think they're going to actually start letting people in at 3, and I think we go on stage at 3:30. So, yeah, I would suggest people get there at 3, but we go on then at 3:30.
This is so good. What'd you think about the snake, the boa that was who left the premises?
Oh, you mean the cobra at the Bronx Zoo?
At the Bronx Zoo. Oh, the boa. Yeah, the cobra. I'm sorry.
Yeah, snake.
It was...
You know, I mean, I my hat's off to the Bronx Zoo. They handled it perfectly. With a snake like that, they did exactly what you need to do, and that's just kind of waited out until it shows itself. And they knew it was contained in the building, so they did a magnificent job. And I think it was hilarious that somebody created that fake account on Twitter and were able to kind of tongue-in-cheek the whole thing as we all patiently waited to see when they would find it. So it was pretty cute.
Yeah, I heard about that. I didn't go to Twitter to check it out, but I mean, have you ever been to the Bronx Zoo?
No, unfortunately, the three times I've been here to New York, it's been for business, and we have had a very tight schedule. We fly in, we do all our media stuff, and then we fly right back out because we got to get our animals back home, you know, as soon as possible. I do hope to come out here sometime on my own, vacationing with my family. I would love to visit New York more as a tourist than here on business, that's for sure.
Well, if you do, I would like to take you to some of the. It's interesting to see each of the boroughs, like they have their own like zoo. But
mm-hmm.
I tell people, but if you can't get the best of it, is you have to go to the Bronx.
Right. I've heard great things about the Bronx Zoo. That's for sure. I just have yet to make it over there.
Yeah, I used to when I grew up. I think I was about a mile away from there. So it was like,
nice.
Okay, hey, what do you want to do today? I don't know. Hey, let's go to the Bronx Zoo. Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Or you go across the street and they'll say, I've been to the zoo enough. Let's go over to the Bronx Botanical Gardens instead.
Yeah.
Which is another thing. It's like if you want to go to the Botanical Gardens, you know, you'll find in each of the boroughs. But if you want the real big one, you go to the Bronx. You know, that's the kind of thing. But actually, it'd be interesting for you to go to the Bronx Zoo and see how it compares, like, to the San Diego Zoo.
Right. Well, you know, I have been to several zoos throughout the nation, and it's not something that I really go around comparing them so much as I go around and really enjoy them and what they have to offer for their site and their location, their history, and the work that they do. The really neat thing that some people find surprising is that zoos all tend to work together. You know, sometimes we think about in business, there's trade secrets, and there must be some sort of competition or something to compare. The neat thing about the zoo environment and people who work in zoos is we all share information all the time because we all work together in the bigger picture of preserving these animals, educating the public, doing work out in the wild, out in Africa, out in Asia and South America, setting up our conservation efforts as a group effort. We're much stronger than trying to do it all individually. So I do appreciate and enjoy going to the zoos and checking them out and looking at what they have to offer and how they take on educating the world and their efforts towards conservation.
Yeah. One other interesting experience that I had was in Disney World, that there's a hotel facility that's like South African.
Oh, really?
In their backyard, so to speak. I just see animals wandering around.
Oh, yeah, it's part of the wild kingdom, probably. Yeah.
So it's like you wake up in the morning and you're hearing the animals like right outside your window.
Yeah.
You're in no way in any position to be able to actually be near them.
Mm-hmm.
But you're looking out your window and you're just, you know, just kind of watching this. And they're just, although in that kind of a case, there will be people that are going out to the area and, like, you know, to feed them and things like that.
Right.
So they're used, they see people as opposed to when you're on, like, a safari or a game ride, not anybody going out to feed them.
Exactly.
No zoo, no nothing. Just, yeah, they're out there. They're in their environment. They're roaming around. Just, you know, leave alone. And the other question I had, because I know, like, for instance, in, when I did the game rides, the thing I was told, that they were told, is don't stand up because the animals are used to seeing these vehicles, so there's no problem. But if you stand, they're seeing something with, if they see something with a different height or something, then that upsets them.
Well, yeah, you know, I think with most animals, especially when you're out there on a game reserve, you know, in a vehicle, a Land Rover, something like that, something that does appear out of the norm for those animals might, you know, make them concerned or whatever the case may be. So the nice thing about what we have going on at the San Diego Zoo Safari Park, though, is that our animals are accustomed to seeing the Segways and the trams and the caravans.
Right.
And it's one of those opportunities where they take it in stride because they're used to it. That's for sure. But I got to tell you, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yes,
I need to get going because we've got quite a schedule tomorrow, and I need to.
Okay.
My beauty sleep.
I appreciate
sure.
you calling in and
my
telling us all about this,
me.
And I'll be chatting with you about my coming out there. To, you know.
Certainly, yes.
Okay.
That would be great to see you.
Okay, thanks so much, Rick, and this is just a wonderful. It sounds like going to be a wonderful experience.
It really is. And, you know, if your listeners want to find out more, they can always go to either sandiegozoo.org. That has a link to both of our websites for the zoo and the safari park. If your listeners love to do Facebook or Twitter, we have Facebook and Twitter accounts, one for the San Diego Zoo and one for the safari park called SDZ Safari Park. And with that, if they do plan on coming out to travel, they can follow on Twitter for either special promotions or discounts or find out what's going on before they visit. So it's really a lot of fun and very interactive.
Great. All right, thank you again. And
my pleasure.
I'll try to watch it tomorrow morning. I'll wake up
great.
Early just to watch it, okay?
Oh, great, sounds good. All right, you have
All
a good
right.
night. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, that's really, I'm looking forward. I hope I can get out there to San Diego to experience this all. I don't know about the zip line, though. I mean, yeah. So, well, I'm going to, end the show a little early. I'm hungry from that first interview and thirsty from all the talking. So, I don't know what I'm doing next week. Oh, yeah, I'll be in Boston next week, although not sure if I'll be broadcasting from Boston. Haven't decided yet. But whatever, I know there's a lot of things coming up. Oh, I just wanted to talk about the show that I saw, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. So it's, as I said, it starred Daniel Radcliffe and John Larroquette. And I have to, it was just absolutely wonderful. I'm not going to compare it to the original show in 1961 or the movie. I mean, I don't really care. In terms of being entertained, that's what makes it really important about critiquing. The songs, there's nothing. I don't know what we could say about the songs. I mean, the songs, it's like. Well, I guess if you're young, you don't know the songs. But basically, the songs had become popular enough for people to recognize the score. If not, I think you probably like the score anyway. They're really they're pretty good numbers. The choreography was amazing, just amazing. One thing that there was a song, a production number with the song Brotherhood of Man that absolutely brought down the house. It was amazing to see Daniel Radcliffe with the dancing, the movements, and just the whole cast. It definitely captures your attention in terms of energy. And just for anybody who doesn't know, the basic storyline is that Daniel Radcliffe plays, Pierpoint is his last name. And what did he say? He's a window washer. As he's washing the windows at this big business, he's also reading this book called How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And he's going along with the points of what the book tells him to do. And as he does it, he keeps rising with the getting into the company and rising to higher positions very quickly. And a lot of things just, coincidental, or that what he does is he looks ahead to check about the people that are there. And, so it's because it's 1961, I mean, when they did it, you don't expect it to be feminist at all. I mean, it's very typical. It's a men's. You know, the men are doing the jobs and the women are doing the secretarial work. It's that time. One thing that I caught that I found humorous, there was a comment, one of the secretaries gets somebody starts to talk to her, wants to take her away, and she says something about, I was just having a Metrical. And I laughed because I thought, who is going to know what Metrical is unless you've been around at that time? Metrical was, I guess, what was your Slim Fast kind of thing, where you had Metrical instead of a meal. And so that's what that was. And for me, I laughed because one of the jokes that I used to say, which, again, no one will understand now, is I said, did you hear that Metrical won the Nobel Prize? Okay. But other than that, I don't think, the era is not going to, I guess, the clothing of the time, but... nothing else. I just, it's a hit. It's definitely going to be a smash hit. And I would highly recommend it to anybody coming into New York and they want to see a show that they're not, they're going to be satisfied, go to it. As far as, let's see, I sat in the rear orchestra and no problem. Didn't lose anything by being that far back at all. I don't think there would be a bad seat in the house the way it was all set up at all. It's I think the one thing that I appreciated, that I could comment, I guess, is that it's not a play where you really have to concentrate on somebody's facial expression so that they're that distance, it's going to make a difference. Oh, did he blink his eye or whatever? Everything is done in a way so even if you're at a distance, you'd pretty much catch it all. If you're worried about getting a seat and go for whatever you want, whatever pleases you on the seats. So that's my take on the show. It's playing at the Hirschfield Theater, which is like 8th Avenue, like right off of 8th Avenue, between 8th and 9th, but just near 8th Avenue as opposed to on between 7th Broadway and 8th, where most of the shows are. But, that doesn't, make a difference. Great theater, great theater. And as I said, I hope if you're coming to New York, go, definitely go see it. All right, so, yep, so until next time, everybody have a good day, have a good evening and morning, or whatever the heck you're listening to this. I just, yes, I just get away from the snow. Well, there's no business like snow business. Well, bye, everybody.